Please join me at Exodus chapter number 30, where we are now going to fill in a gap that was in our information from earlier. We were talking about how the tabernacle has certain furniture pieces inside of it that are going to be used to worship the Lord and be aware of His kingship and the need to appeal to Him for forgiveness of sins and things like that. So we know that the tabernacle building is divided into two portions. The back portion is the Holy of Holies, and it is a cube. It's 10 cubits by 10 cubits by 10 cubits. Only thing in that section of the tabernacle is the Ark of the Covenant, which is the throne of God, because the Ark is not a decorated storage box. It is a sedan chair. It is a portable throne, and it is the throne of God. And His voice emanates in the time of Moses from above the mercy seat between the two cherubim, whose wings go up and over the mercy seat like a canopy on a special portable throne. So that's the only thing in the Holy of Holies. The room in front of the Holy of Holies we call the Holy Place, and it has the table of the bread of God's presence, which is like a God's dinner table, if you will. It's got 12 loaves of bread to represent the 12 tribes of Israel on it. It has cups with the drink offerings on it. I would suggest probably 12 cups on it. It's got bowls of incense on it as well. I think probably 12 bowls of incense. And that table of God's presence sits there 7 days a week as a representation of fellowship between the people of Israel and God, the King. And at the end of each week, the beginning of the new week, those things are swapped out. And we find out later in Scripture that the priests that are coming on duty after the Sabbath and the priests going off duty after the Sabbath, they share in the bread and the wine of that particular table as part of their fellowship as priests serving God. And that sounds all the world to me like weekly communion, and I love the symbolism of it. Now, across from that, because that's on the north side, across from that is the seven-branched lampstand. The seven branches, I believe, represent the 7 days of the week, and the lamps on that are shining 24 hours a day. And I think it represents the Word of God that lights our paths, lights our days as we serve Him, just like those lamps lit the work of the priests coming into that holy place serving God. So that's all that we knew about up to this point. But now we find out there is an item that gets put right on the transitions from the holy place where the priests do their work and the most holy place where God is seated his throne, is seated upon his throne. And so this is called the altar of incense. I also like to call it the altar of prayer. And it is a representation of our communication day by day with God. And so here's its description, chapter 30 of Exodus, verse 1. You shall make an altar on which to burn incense. You shall make it of acacia wood, just like all the other things. That's the base material. A cubit shall be its length. Now, you remember, I am convinced that all of these measurements use the long cubit, which is 20.7 inches long. So that means that this thing is going to be 1 foot, 8.5 inch, 8.7 inches across, and it's going to be squared on the top, same dimension both directions. So a cubit shall be its length, and a cubit its breadth. It shall be square. And 2 cubits shall be its height. So it's going to be 3 feet, 5.4 inches tall, which means it's not even going to come up to the chest of Aaron or any priest that's coming in here to perform their responsibilities of prayer and incense. It is a place where they're going to put coals taken from the altar of sacrifice and use that to ignite the incense into a billowing cloud at exactly the moment that the sacrifice is offered in the morning outside and the sacrifice is offered in the afternoon outside. And that billowing smoke, as the book of Revelation tells us, symbolizes the prayers of all the saints. Now, just like that massive altar of sacrifice in the forecourt, this prayer altar has horns on it. It says, its horns shall be of one piece with it. Now you shall overlay it all with gold, its top and around its sides and its horns. So they are supposed to make this out of acacia wood, and they're supposed to overlay it with gold, and then at the four corners of the top, there is supposed to be these little symbolic horns, because horns represent power, physical power usually, but it comes symbolic of ability to command those to do things on your behalf. And so these horns are going to be points of contact for some ceremonies later. Verse number 3 continues, you shall make a molding of gold around it. That's going to keep the burning area very well defined. And you shall make 2 golden rings for it. Under its molding on 2 opposite sides of it, you shall make them, and they shall be holders for poles with which to carry it. You shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. And so this item is going to be carried from encampment to encampment on poles, just like everything else. They are not to be hand carried. You're not supposed to be touching them because they are set aside for specific purposes. They are to have rings that you can put these poles in, lift them up, and move them around, and never be put on a cart or anything of that nature, even though that becomes a story later. Now, this particular piece of furniture is going to be butted right up against the dividing line between the holy and most holy place, which is why I think in the book of Hebrews, it is actually associated with the Holy of Holies rather than the holy place, because it is a transition thing. Because prayer connects us on earth with God in heaven. And so it really has a lot more to do with God. All right, on to the rest of the passage here. You shall put it in front of the veil that is above the ark of the testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony, where I will meet with you. So I think logistically, if you can imagine it with these words, whenever they set up the tabernacle, they will put the Ark of the Covenant into the Holy of Holies. Its poles are going to be sticking out into the holy place where the priests do their work. They then put up the veil that divides the two places. And either the veil kind of sits on top of those projecting poles of the Ark of the Covenant, or the Ark of the Covenant holds them back so that there's like a little gap to be able to see in there. But regardless of that, when they bring this item in, they put it right up against where that veil is, so that I believe it sits right between the two projecting carrying poles, which are never moved, by the way. They're never taken out of the Ark of the Covenant. And so that means there's only going to be about enough room on either side of this incense altar for an average-sized man to get his hips through. Because once a year, the high priest is going to go past the ark of or the altar of incense and go up to the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant and offer blood on the mercy seat. And so the projecting carrying poles of the Ark of the Covenant are actually going to limit the space that he can go into. And again, this is one of the reasons I think that the golden altar of incense is closely connected to the Ark of the Covenant and to the Holy of Holies. Verse number 7, Aaron, meaning the high priest, shall burn incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps at twilight, he shall burn it. A regular incense offering before he who is throughout your generations. Now, again, I think we have some things that get tweaked over the centuries. It seems as if Aaron is going to be the officiating priest for morning prayer and evening prayer every single day of the year. That's what it seems to be at the very beginning. Now, later, we know for a fact that they cast lots of all the descendants of Aaron who were on duty in the temple for a two-week period, and they were given the privilege, the responsibility of offering the incense for the day. And this is the story in Luke chapter 1 about how Zechariah, the father of John the Immerser, was tapped by the lot to go in and offer the prayer of incense at one of the two official times. So that seems to have changed over time from just the high priest doing it to any legitimately selected high priest or priest, officiating priest. Now, the other thing that I already mentioned is that I suspect that at the very beginning, the incense and the sacrifice was offered first thing in the morning, right after sunrise. And we actually see here that the high priest, Aaron, is going to be responsible for changing out the wicks and filling up the oil reservoirs in the morning on the seven-branched lampstand, on all seven lamps. And then he's going to do it again as part of his evening prayer ritual, evening incense ritual. He's going to swap out burnt up wicks and fill up the oil reservoirs. So all of this is part of the daily maintenance of relationship, keeping the light of God burning and keeping the people praying to their king all day long, as represented by the morning and evening incense and sacrifices. Now, verse 9, you shall not offer unauthorized incense on it. That will become very important later. So file that away in your head. Later, we will actually refer to it as unauthorized fire. Okay? You shall not offer unauthorized incense on it or a burnt offering. So there's no animal sacrifices that go onto this altar. Or a grain offering. So it doesn't even matter if you want to do vegetable or some type of grain. You shall not pour a drink offering on it. So the only thing that goes on it is incense. And the formula for that incense is coming up later in the instructions from God to Moses. Verse 10, Aaron shall make atonement on its horns once a year. That will be Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And we will talk more about that when we get to that section. With the blood of the sin offering of atonement, he shall make atonement for it once in the year throughout your generations. We can think of about it as kind of being like a recharging of all of the all the different parts and components of the sacrificial system. Yom Kippur is the restart date every year. It is most holy to he who is. So this incense altar, just like the menorah, just like the table of the bread of the presence, just like the Ark of the Covenant, just like the altar of sacrifice and the great big water tank, all of it is set aside only for specific use to God. And so that makes them holy. Verse 11. He who is said to Moses, when you take the census of the people of Israel, so this is already in mind, is that they will make an official counting of all the men of the nation, because each of the men are going to be on a list to receive a piece of property once they arrive in the promised land. And so that piece of property will belong to the man and his family members into perpetuity. And then we'll have ways that that transition from one generation to the next is going to be taken care of. That'll be later. So whenever you get around to that, then each of those designated persons on the census list shall give a ransom for his life to he who is when you number them, that there be no plague among them when you number them. So everybody that wants to be a participant in the covenant and in the promised land has to pay to the work of the Lord something. They have to be invested in it. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give this, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs. Now, when Moses is writing this, talking about in the 15th century BC, there's no such thing as coins yet. Coins don't come into existence for many centuries after this. Money, precious metal, which counts as value, is measured by weight. And there is a standard of weight that has been established long before Moses of what a shekel is. A shekel seems to almost be the base weight item. It doesn't really matter how much a shekel is, I guess, to us. I think it's a few grams. Less than an ounce, if I'm not mistaken. Let me see here if I can find that real quick. I didn't put it down for easy reference. Shekel is about 2/5 of an ounce. There we go. It's about 11 grams. So half a shekel, though, buying power-wise, later we'll find out is roughly one day's wage. Now, that's later, much later in the story that we find that to be the case. But it makes sense that everybody gives one day's wage to show that they are invested in this relationship, in this community. Half a shekel as an offering to he who is. So you give one day's wage to the king for the king's usage. Then we find out a little bit about majority age for the Israelis. everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward. So you have to have reached your 20th birthday in Israeli society of this period to be counted as an adult, as a full-fledged member of the community. Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward shall give he who is his offering. The rich shall not give more. See, the rich can't be more invested in the community of King Yahweh, King he who is. Nobody is a greater citizen just because they have more money. And the poor shall not give less. So everybody has to be responsible to give one day's average wage in order to be part of the whole. Than the half shekel, which you give he who is his offering to make atonement for your lives. And this is, again, a reminder that God redeemed them out of Egypt. They are now his people. They belong to him. And so if he says everybody kicks in half a shekel, then everybody has to kick in half a shekel. You shall take the atonement money from the people of Israel and shall give it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may bring the people of Israel to remembrance before he who is, so as to make atonement for your lives. And that is what will later be referred to as the temple tax. And they were still giving it in the first century in the New Testament. You might remember that Peter was accosted by some collectors of this annual tax for the temple. Does your master pay? And Peter goes, well, of course he does. And Jesus stops him when he comes into the building. He says, so Peter, got a question for you. Who pays taxes? The king's son or other people? And Peter's like, the other people. And so Jesus says, okay, I'm glad you understand that, which I think is a way of saying, I'm the Son of God. I would not have to pay this taxes unless I voluntarily do it. And so the next thing you see Jesus do is say, all right, Peter, so that we don't offend them, so that we don't cause them a problem, you know, an attitude problem that might lead them to some sort of sinful attitude, you go out, throw a hook, you know, a fishing hook, into the lake, and open up the mouth of the first fish you pull out. And so Peter did. And guess what? He found a didrachma, a double drachma coin, which means a coin that was for 2 days' wages. And Peter had been given the instructions that once he found that coin, he should give it to the collectors of the temple tax for himself and for Jesus. And so that's a New Testament story that's related to this part right here. That even to the New Testament period, every Israeli was expected to kick in 1 day's wage to keep things moving worship-wise, atonement-wise in the temple. Just an interesting side note. When the temple was destroyed in AD 70, the emperor decided that that tax for the upkeep of the temple should be diverted into the Roman revenue storage for their use, because it wasn't being used to keep up the temple anymore. Now, on to the rest of our story here. We talked about all the things inside the building. We had one thing outside the building that hadn't been mentioned before, even though I myself mentioned it. And that's going to be found in verse number 15 or 17. He who is said to Moses, you shall also make a basin of bronze. Now, in some of our older versions, I think it uses the word laver here. And in a lot of the portrayals of this, it looks like a bird bath. Now, I know there's some places that have this little fountain. They call it a laver. They use it to do baby christenings and things like that. That is a misunderstanding of what this word is here in the Exodus 30 text. The word basin is actually the word for a gigantic cauldron, a cauldron that is used to make lots of food, but also a cauldron that was used to smelt metal. So it's not a little thing, it's a big thing. And I think it's probably big enough to hold a lot of water. When we get to the description of the temple, it is massive. And it sits on the back of 12 full-sized models of bulls. But you shall make this basin of bronze with its stand of bronze. So it's got some sort of thing underneath it that holds it either up off the ground or perhaps even catches the water that's coming out of it. And you're going to put it there for washing. You shall put it between the tent of meeting and the altar. You should put water in it, with which Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet. So it's got a practical purpose. You get dirty when you're doing sacrifices, and you need a constant washing. It's also the place where the priests wash completely before they become priests. When they go into the tent of meeting, when they come near to the altar of the minister to burn a food offering to he who is, they shall wash with water so that they may not die. See, they have to stay ceremonially clean. They shall wash their hands and their feet so that they may not die. It shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his offspring throughout their generations. Now, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I still have a little bit more to say on this the next time we get into the Word.